I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. On the wind that lifts her perfume through the air,
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitation. I'm backing up.
Well, hello, I'm Solazar, and welcome to Good Vibrations Radio, Tools for Transformation. Now, quantum physics tells us that we're all energy vibrating at different frequencies, and in Good Vibrations Radio, we bring you information that allows you to change the vibrational frequency of your life. We're your source for everyday alchemy, so you can take the lead in your life and turn it into gold. Good Vibrations Radio is made possible through the sponsorship of Magic for Life, the promoter-producer of the Rhoda Psychic Fair. The Rhoda Psychic Fair has been a constant in Monterey County for the past 34 years. Our last fair was October 21st and 22nd, and our next event is October 27th and 28th of 2018 at the Monterey County Fairgrounds. I encourage you to sign up for the email list on rhodapsychicfair.com and goodvibrationsradio.com so you can be notified about the upcoming events. On Friday, this December 29th, we're holding an online quarterly preview where we'll discuss the energy of 2018 as well as the detail of the months of January, February, and March. Joyce Day Muse will share the astrological guidance. Kirilani will share the numerology and the numerological vibrations, and I'll share the wisdom of the tarot. Now, our last quarterly preview was September 29th. At that time, I drew the card of the King of Water from the Osho Zen Tarot deck as the transition card to 2018. The primary message of that card is to rid yourself of prejudice. Allow yourself to be empathic toward others before passing judgment. Surrender to the love in your heart. As we complete the energy of December, which is to operate from who you are and break from the bonds that hold you back, the bonds of other people's expectations about who you are versus who you really are. This transition card of the King of Water is encouraging you to heal your wounds so that you only operate from love and empathy. For the remainder of this week, allow yourself to surrender to that love, to love yourself, to heal your wounds, and to operate from who you truly are. You know, before we get into the show, let me tell you a little bit about me. I'm a speaker, performer, a reader, a healer, a radio host, and an author. I've been part of the metaphysical community all my life, and along the way, I completed a series of formal studies as well. In this show, we share a variety of topics, all focused on the idea of informing you so you can make better decisions in your life. For the past 10 years, I've been broadcasting Good Vibrations Radio. Starting in 2018, I intend to shift some of the focus. Now, for those who listen regularly, stay tuned as we shift. It will be a journey of learning for all of us. You know I like to start each show with a reading from Day by Day with James Allen. Now, in 1903, James Allen published his essay, As a Man Thinketh. Allen chose the title from chapter 23, verse 7 of Proverbs, which says, As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. It was described by Allen as a book that will help you help yourself. Allen wanted all of us to know that in your own thought world, you hold the key to every condition, good or bad, that enters your life. Your present reality is a direct outcome of your past thoughts, intentions, beliefs, and actions. But your future is not predestined by your past. By working patiently and intelligently on your thoughts, your intentions, and your beliefs, you can remake your life and transform your circumstances. And Day by Day with James Allen, his essay has been broken into a separate section for each day of the month. And for the 25th day of the month, James Allen shares, "Believe it's possible. Belief is the basis of all action. And this being so, the belief that dominates the hearts or minds is shown in the life." What he means by "is shown" is reflected in the life. So if you're looking to change your life, don't focus on changing your behavior. Focus on changing your thoughts and beliefs. One of the best examples of changing your thoughts and beliefs is the story of Roger Bannister and the 4-minute mile. See, many people believe running a mile under 4 minutes was humanly impossible. No one was able to accomplish it. And in 1954, Roger Bannister ran a mile in 3 minutes, 59.04 seconds. Once the 4-minute mile was broken, within another month and a half, another runner broke the 4-minute mile. And since then, the 4-minute mile has been broken again and again and again. As a matter of fact, it's considered the standard for measuring world-class middle distance runners. So once the belief that a human could not run a mile less than 4 minutes was broken and shown that a human could run a mile in less than 4 minutes, it's now become the standard instead of an impossibility. So stop believing in what you cannot do. Start believing in what you can do as you journey toward 2018. I've shared many times that I have a series of prayers and affirmations I use each day to help me focus on the positive, to help me in those shifts of the thoughts and beliefs. I do a morning and evening series of forgiveness prayers. I do a gratitude affirmation. I do Ho'oponopono. I do unconditional love affirmations. And I collect a positive thought from the daily word produced by the Unity School of Christianity. The daily word for Monday, December 25th, states, "I welcome the rebirth of Christmas spirit into my heart today." Now, whether you're a believer in Christmas or not, this season has represented the season of light to all people and all faiths. The greatest light in your world is your inner light. Each of us is born divine into this physical world. Your inner light is your divinity. It's the essence of who you express to the world. And in our movement to 2018, this message reminds you to review how you are choosing to be and choosing to express yourself in the world. I welcome the rebirth of Christmas spirit into my heart today. Bringing out your light and expressing your divinity is your purpose in the world. It's also your focus for this week as you journey toward 2018. Now, for Christians, Christmas is seen as the birth of the light of God, the Son of Man, Jesus. So as part of my tribute to Christmas, I want to touch on the true story of Christmas. You know, in the Northern Hemisphere, the shortest day and longest night of the year falls on December 21st or December 22nd, and it's called the winter solstice. Now, ancient people believed that the sun was a god and that winter came every year because the sun god had become sick and weak. And they celebrated the solstice because it meant at last the sun god would begin to get well. We had gone to the darkest point, or what they call the night of the midnight sun and we were now returning to the light. Evergreen boughs reminded them of the green plants that would grow again, and they would gather them and make wreaths and put different ornaments on them. And they would remind them that the sun god was strong and summer would return. And the ancient Egyptians worshipped a god called Ra, who had the head of a hawk and wore the sun as a blazing disc on his crown. And at the solstice, when Ra began to recover from his illness, the Egyptians filled their homes with green palm rushes, which symbolized for them the triumph of life over death. And early Romans marked the solstice with a feast called the Saturnalia in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture. Now, the Romans knew that the solstice meant that soon farms and orchards would be green and fruitful again. And to mark the occasion, they decorated their homes and temples with evergreen boughs. In Northern Europe, the mysterious Druids, the priests of the ancient Celts, also decorated their temples with evergreen boughs as a symbol of everlasting life. The Vikings in Scandinavia thought the evergreens were the special plant of the sun god Balder. Germany is credited with starting the Christmas tree tradition as we know it. It started apparently in the 16th century when devout Christians brought decorated trees into their home. And some built Christmas pyramids of wood and decorated them with evergreens and candles if wood was scarce. And it's a widely held belief that Martin Luther, the 16th century Protestant reformer, first added lighted candles to a tree. Apparently, according to legend, walking toward his home one winter evening, composing a sermon, he was awed by the brilliance of stars twinkling amidst the evergreens. And to recapture that for his family, he erected a tree in the main room and wired its branches with lighted candles. Most 19th century Americans found Christmas trees an oddity. The first record of one being on display was in the 1830s by the German settlers of Pennsylvania. Although trees had been a tradition in many German homes earlier, as we've already mentioned, the Pennsylvania German settlements had community trees as early as 1747, but not private trees. And as late as 1840s, Christmas trees were seen as pagan symbols, and they weren't accepted by most Americans. It would be easy enough to imagine Christmas as a simple continuum of traditions dating from the birth of Christ. You'd begin with the nativity story, apply the December 25th date to Jesus's birth, establish the gift-giving precedent of the Magi, and work from there. However, the gospel that founded the synoptic gospels of Mark, Luke, and Matthew, doesn't even mention the nativity. There's no nativity story in Mark. And that's the foundational gospel of the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew and Luke are seem to have evolved from Mark. Yet there's no nativity story in Mark. Over the centuries, however, Christmas traditions accumulated, often beginning with things such as the Yule log, followed by the Christmas tree, and following winding up in the present day with giant inflatable snowmen and icicle lights. Many of the traditions and legends came from ancient traditions that existed long before there was a story of Jesus, the Christ, and Christmas. The history is hardly a continuum. It's really a varied and riotous story that predates the birth of Christ. Early Europeans marked the longest night, the winter solstice, as the beginning of longer days and the rebirth of the sun. They slaughtered livestock that couldn't be kept through the winter and feasted from late December through January. German pagans honored Odin, the frightening god who flew over settlements at night, blessing some people and cursing others. The Norse in Scandinavia celebrated Yuletide, and each family burnt a giant log and feasted until it turned to ash. In Rome, as I've mentioned, they celebrated the raucous festival of Saturnalia from December 17th to December 24th in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture. The celebration consisted of a carnival-like period of feasting, carousing, gambling, gift-giving, and upended social positions. Slaves could don their master's clothes and refuse orders, and children had command over adults. Two other Roman festivals, Juvenalia, a feast in honor of Rome's children, and Mithras, a celebration in honor of the infant god Mithra, also fell near to the solstice, which helped extend that whole celebration. By the 4th century, the Catholic Church decided that Christians needed a December holiday to rival the solstice celebrations, and they selected December 25th for the Feast of the Nativity. You see, it's not predestined. It's not written into the Bible. It was selected, and it was selected because that way the people already had a flavor and taste of celebrating at that time of the year, and the Roman Catholic Church wanted to add a celebration at that time so it would fall in with people's expectations. Christmas gained ground over the several hundred years, becoming a full-fledged holiday by the 9th century, although it was still considered less important than Good Friday and Easter. Early Christmas was not peaceful, the holiday we know it today. Its proximity to Saturnalia resulted in its absorbing some of the Roman festival's excesses. And in the Middle Ages included feasting and drinking and riotous behavior and caroling for money. And religious Puritans disapproved of such excess in the name of Christ and considered the holiday blasphemous. Oliver Cromwell went so far as to cancel Christmas when he seized control of England in 1645. Decorations were forbidden, and soldiers patrolled the street in search of celebrants cooking meals. Puritans in the American colonies took a similarly dour view of Christmas. Yuletide festivities were outlawed in Boston from 1659 through 1681. But by the late 18th century and through the 19th century, Christmas began to take on some tame associations in the U.S., some of the ones that it has today. Washington Irving wrote popular stories about Christmas that invented and appropriated old traditions, presenting them as the customs of the English gentry. Queen Victoria's German husband, Prince Albert, introduced a Christmas tree to Windsor Castle in 1846. An engraving of the couple with their children in front of the tree popularized the custom throughout England and the United States. And in the 20th century, the focus of Christmas became increasingly commercial. And especially when you look at the miracle on 42nd Street, what you're really talking about is a movie done to support the commercialization of Christmas by Macy's and Gimbel's. You see, it was business that chose to popularize Christmas so that they could sell, because other than that, this was a slow time of the year for retail. In the 20th century, it's become so commercial. And even though I won't talk more about the prospect of presents and the history of Christmas gifts, many of you know from listening through the years that I'm an anti-theist. I'm not a believer in organized religion. And in addition, I'm not a believer that Jesus existed either as man or as Son of God. However, this show is not to deal with the history of the mythology of Jesus, only this history of Christmas and whether Christmas is a time of celebration, the birth of Jesus, or if this really is a time for all of us to celebrate the season of light and that inner light of divinity we carry. I want to share a story that I read. I read it as a teenager, but it was written by the noted science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, called The Last Question. It first appeared in the November 1956 issue of Science Fiction Quarterly and has been included in a series of anthologies ever since. Isaac Asimov himself considered it the favorite of all of his stories, and it contains an overlap of science fiction, theology, and philosophy. To complete our Christmas journey today, I offer this audio recording of Isaac Asimov's The Last Question, first written in 1956.
A dramatic science fiction story, The Last Question, by Isaac Asimov, one of the most prolific sci-fi writers of all time. Featuring Jim Gallant as the storyteller. Produced, engineered, sound effects and original music written and performed by Bob E. Flick. Drums and percussion performed by the Cosmic Rhythm Master, Conan, with sound design and sonic soundscape imagery created by Viondo. This production was recorded at the Audio Art Recording Studios in Topanga, California, with Commander Audio at the helm. And now, Isaac Asimov's The Last Question. The last question was asked for the first time, half in jest, on May 21, 2061, at a time when humanity first stepped into the light. The question came about as a result of a $5 bet over highballs, and it happened this way. Alexander Adell and Bertram Lupoff were two of the faithful attendants of Multivac. As well as any human beings could, they knew what lay behind the cold, clicking, flashing face, miles and miles of face, of that giant computer. They had at least a vague notion of the general plan of relays and circuits that had long since grown past the point where any single human could possibly have a firm grasp of the whole. Multivac was self-adjusting and self-correcting. It had to be, for nothing human could adjust and correct it quickly enough or even adequately enough. So Adell and Lupoff attended the monstrous giant only lightly and superficially, yet as well as any men could. They fed it data, adjusted questions to its needs, and translated the answers that were issued. Certainly they, and all others like them, were fully entitled to share in the glory that was Multivac's. For decades, Multivac had helped design the ships and plot the trajectories that enabled man to reach the Moon, Mars, and Venus. But past that, Earth's poor resources could not support the ships. Too much energy was needed for the long trips. Earth exploited its coal and uranium with increasing efficiency, but there was only so much of both. But slowly Multivac learned enough to answer deeper questions more fundamentally. And on May 14, 2061, what had been theory became fact. The energy of the sun was stored, converted, and utilized directly on a planet-wide scale. All Earth turned off its burning coal, its fissioning uranium, and flipped the switch that connected all of it to a small station, 1 mile in diameter, circling the Earth at half the distance of the Moon. All Earth ran by invisible beams of sun power. 7 days had not sufficed to dim the glory of it, and Adell and Lupoff finally managed to escape from the public function and to meet in quiet, where no one would think of looking for them, in the deserted underground chambers where portions of the mighty buried body of Multivac showed. Unattended, idling, sorting data with contented lazy clickings, Multivac, too, had earned its vacation, and the boys appreciated that. They had no intention, originally, of disturbing it. They had brought a bottle with them, and their only concern at the moment was to relax in the company of each other and the bottle.
"It's amazing when you think of it," said Adell. His broad face had lines of weariness in it,
and he stirred his drink slowly with a glass rod, watching the cubes of ice slur clumsily about.
"All the energy we can possibly ever use for free. Energy enough, if we wanted to draw on it, to melt all Earth into a big drop of impure liquid iron, and still never miss the energy so used. All the energy we could ever use, forever and forever and forever." Lupov cocked his head sideways. He had a trick of doing that when he wanted to be contrary, and he wanted to be contrary now, partly because he had had to carry the ice and glassware.
Not forever, he said.
Oh, hell, just about forever. Till the sun runs down, Bert.
That's not forever.
All right, then. Billions and billions of years. 20 billion, maybe. Are you satisfied?
Lupov put his fingers through his thinning hair as though to reassure himself that some was still left, and sipped gently at his own drink.
20 billion years isn't forever.
Well, it will last our time, won't it?
So would the coal and uranium.
All right, but now we can hook up each individual spaceship to the solar station, and it can go to Pluto and back a million times without ever worrying about fuel. You can't do that on coal and uranium. Ask Multivac if you don't believe me.
I don't have to ask Multivac, I know that.
Then stop running down what Multivac's done for us, said Adele, blazing up. It did all right.
Who says it didn't? What I say is that a sun won't last forever, that's all I'm saying. We're safe for 20 billion years, but then what?
Lupov pointed a slightly shaky finger at the other.
And don't say we'll switch to another sun.
There was silence for a while. Adele put his glass to his lips only occasionally, and Lupov's eyes slowly closed. They rested. Then Lupov's eyes snapped open.
You're thinking we'll switch to another sun when ours is done, aren't you?
I'm not thinking.
Sure you are. You're weak on logic. That's the trouble with you. You're like the guy in the story who was caught in a sudden shower and who ran to a grove of trees and got under one. He wasn't worried, you see, because he figured when one tree got wet through, he would just get under another one.
I get it, said Adele. Don't shout. When the sun is done, the other stars will be gone too.
Damn right they will, muttered Lupov. It all had a beginning in the original cosmic explosion, whatever that was. And it'll all have an end when all the stars run down. Some run down faster than others. Hell, the giants won't last 100 million years. The sun will last 20 billion years. And maybe the dwarfs will last, 100 billion, for all the good they are. But just give us 1 trillion years, and everything will be dark. Entropy has to increase to maximum. That's all.
I know all about entropy, said Adele, standing on his dignity.
The hell you do?
I know as much as you do.
Then you know everything's got to run down someday.
All right, who says it won't?
You did, you poor sap. You said we had all the energy we needed forever. You said forever.
It was Adele's turn to be contrary.
Maybe we can build things up again someday, he said.
Never.
Why not? Someday.
Never.
Ask Multivac.
You ask Multivac. I dare you. $5 says it can't be done.
Adele was just drunk enough to try, just sober enough to be able to phrase the necessary symbols and operations into a question which, in words, might have corresponded to this. Will mankind one day, without the net expenditure of energy, be able to restore the sun to its full youthfulness even after it had died of old age? Or maybe it could be put more simply like this. How can the net amount of entropy of the universe be massively decreased? Multivac fell dead and silent. The slow flashing of lights ceased. The distant sounds of clicking relays ended. Then, just as the frightened technicians felt they could hold their breath no longer, there was a sudden springing to life of the teletype attached to that portion of Multivac. 5 words were printed. Insufficient data for meaningful answer.
No bet, whispered Lupov.
They left hurriedly. By next morning, the two, plagued with throbbing head and cottony mouth, had forgotten the incident. Jared, Jaredine, and Jaredette 1 and 2 watched the starry picture in the visiplate change as the passage through hyperspace was completed in its non-time lapse. At once, the ever-pottering of stars gave way to the predominance of a single bright marble disk centered.
That's X-23, said Jared confidently.
His thin hands clamped tightly behind his back, and the knuckles whitened. The little Jaredettes, both girls, had experienced the hyperspace passage for the first time in their lives, and were self-conscious
over the momentary sensation of inside-outness. They buried their giggles and chased one another wildly about their mother, screaming, "We've reached X-23! We've reached X-23! We've..." "Quiet, children," said Geraldine sharply. "Are you sure, Jared? What is there to be but sure?" asked Jared, glancing up at the bulge of featureless metal just under the ceiling. It ran the length of the room, disappearing through the wall at either end. It was as long as the ship. Jared scarcely knew a thing about the thick rod of metal, except that it was called a microvac, that one asked it questions if one wished, that if one did not, it still had its task of guiding the ship to a pre-ordered destination, of feeding on energies from the various subgalactic power stations, of computing the equations for the hyper-special jumps. Jared and his family had only to wait and live in the comfortable residence quarters of the ship. Someone had once told Jared that the AC at the end of microvac stood for analog computer in ancient English, but he was on the edge of forgetting even that. Geraldine's eyes were moist as she watched the visiplate. "I can't help it. I feel funny about leaving Earth." "Why, for Pete's sake," demanded Jared. "We had nothing there. We'll have everything on X-23. You won't be alone. You won't be a pioneer. There are over 1 million people on the planet already. Good Lord, our great-grandchildren will be looking for new worlds because X-23 will be overcrowded." Then, after a reflective pause, "I tell you, it's a lucky thing the computers worked out interstellar travel the way the race is growing." I know, said Geraldine miserably. Geradette, one, said promptly, "Our microwave is the best microwave in the world." "I think so, too," said Jared, tousling her hair. It was a nice feeling to have a microwave of your own, and Jared was glad he was part of his generation and no other. In his father's youth, the only computers had been tremendous machines taking up 100 square miles of land. There was only one to a planet. Planetary ACs, they were called. They'd been growing in size steadily for 1,000 years, and then all at once came refinement. In place of transistors had come molecular valves, so that even the largest planetary AC could be put into a space only half the volume of a spaceship. Jared felt uplifted, as he always did, when he thought that his own personal microvac was many times more complicated than the ancient and primitive multivac that had first tamed the sun, and almost as complicated as Earth's planetary AC, the largest that had first solved the problem of hyperspatial travel and had made trips to the stars possible. "So many stars. So many planets," sighed Geraldine, busy with her own thoughts. "I suppose families will be going out to new planets forever, the way we are now." "Not forever," said Jared with a smile. "It will all stop someday, but not for billions of years. Many billions. Even the stars run down, you know. Entropy must increase."
"What's entropy, Daddy?"
shrilled Geraldette too. "Entropy, little sweet, is just a word which means the amount of running down of the universe. Everything runs down, you know, like your little walkie-talkie robot, remember?"
"Can't you just put in a new power unit, like with my robot?"
"The stars are the power units, dear. Once they're gone, there are no more power units." Geraldette one at once set up a howl.
"Don't let them, Daddy. Don't let the stars run down."
"Now look what you've done," whispered Geraldine, exasperated.
"How was I to know it would frighten them?"
Jared whispered back.
"Ask the microvac,"
wailed Geraldette one.
"Ask him how to turn the stars on again."
"Go ahead," said Geraldine. "It will quiet them down." Geraldette, too, was beginning to cry also. Jared shrugged. Now, honeys, I'll ask microvac. Don't worry, he'll tell us." He asked the microvac, adding quickly, "Print the answer." Jared cupped the strip of thin cellulofilm and said cheerfully, "See now, the microvac says it will take care of everything when the time comes. So don't worry." Geraldine said, "And now, children, it's time for bed. We'll be in our new home soon." Jared read the words on the cellulofilm again before destroying it. "Insufficient data for meaningful answer." He shrugged and looked at the visiplate. X-23 was just ahead.
Thank you.
BJ-23X of Lammoth stared into the black depths of the three-dimensional small-scale map of the galaxy and said, "Are we ridiculous? I wonder, in being so concerned about the matter." MQ-17J of Nikron shook his head. "I think not. You know, the galaxy will be filled in 5 years at the present rate of expansion." Both seemed in their early 20s. Both were tall and perfectly formed. "Still," said BJ-23X, "I hesitate to submit a pessimistic report to the Galactic Council. I wouldn't consider any other kind of report. Stir them up a bit. We've got to stir them up." BJ-23X sighed. "Space is infinite. 100 billion galaxies are there for the taking. More. 100 billion is not infinite, and it's getting less infinite all the time. Consider, 20,000 years ago, mankind first solved the problem of utilizing stellar energy. And a few centuries later, interstellar travel became possible. It took mankind 1 million years to fill one small world, and then only 15,000 years to fill the rest of the galaxy. Now the population doubles every 10 years. BJ-23X interrupted. "We can thank immortality for that." "Very well. Immortality exists, and we have to take it into account. I admit it has its seamy side, this immortality. The Galactic AC has solved many problems for us, but in solving the problem of preventing old age and death, it has undone all its other solutions. Yet you wouldn't want to abandon life, I suppose?" "Not at all," snapped MQ-17J, softening it at once to, "Not yet. I'm by no means old enough." "How old are you?"
223.
"And you?" "I'm still under 200. But to get back to my point, population doubles every 10 years. Once this galaxy is filled, we'll have filled another in 10 years. Another 10 years, and we'll have filled 2 more. Another decade, 4 more. In 100 years, we'll have filled 1,000 galaxies. In 1,000 years, 1,000,000 galaxies. In 10,000 years, the entire known universe. Then what? BJ-23X said, "As a side issue, there's a problem of transportation. I wonder how many sun power units it will take to move galaxies of individuals from one galaxy to the next." "A very good point. Already mankind consumes 2 sun power units per year. Most of it is wasted. After all, our own galaxy alone pours out 1,000 sun power units a year, and we only use 2 of those. Granted, but even with 100% efficiency, we only stave off the end. Our energy requirements are going up in a geometric progression even faster than our population. We'll run out of energy even sooner than we run out of galaxies." "A good point. A very good point. We'll just have to build new stars out of interstellar gas. Or out of dissipated heat?" asked MQ-17J sarcastically. "There may be some way to reverse entropy. We ought to ask the Galactic AC." BJ-23X was not really serious, but MQ-17J pulled out his AC contact from his pocket and placed it on the table before him. "I've half a mind to," he said. "It's something the human race will have to face someday." He stared somberly at his small AC contact. It was only 2 inches cubed and nothing in itself, but it was connected through hyperspace with the great Galactic AC that served all mankind. Hyperspace considered, it was an integral part of the Galactic AC. MQ-17J paused to wonder if someday, in his immortal life, he would get to see the Galactic AC. It was on a little world of its own, a spiderwebbing of force beams holding the matter within which surges of submesons took the place of the old clumsy molecular valves. Yet despite its sub-etheric workings, the Galactic AC was known to be a 4,000 feet across. MQ-17J asked suddenly of his AC contact, "Can entropy ever be reversed?" BJ-23X looked startled and said at once, "Oh, say, I didn't really mean to have you ask that." "Why not? We both know entropy can't be reversed. You can't turn smoke and ash back into a tree." "Do you have trees on your world?" asked MQ-17J. The sound of the Galactic AC startled them into silence. Its voice came thin and beautiful out of the small AC contact on the desk. It said, "There is insufficient data for a meaningful answer." BJ-23X said, "See?" The 2 men thereupon returned to the question of the report they were to make to the Galactic Council. Z-Prime's mind, expand the new galaxy with a faint interest in the countless twists of stars that powered it. He had never seen this one before. Would he ever see them all? So many of them, each with its load of humanity. But a load that was almost a dead weight. More and more, the real essence of men was to be found out here, in space. Minds, not bodies. The immortal bodies remained back on the planets in suspension over the eons. Sometimes they roused for material activity, but that was growing rarer. Few new individuals were coming into existence to join the incredibly mighty throng. But what matter? There was little room in the universe for new individuals. Z-Prime was roused out of his reverie upon coming across the wispy tendrils of another mind. "I am Z-Prime," said Z-Prime. "And you?" "I am D-1. "Your galaxy?" "We call it only the galaxy." "And you?" "We call ours the same. All men call their galaxy, and nothing more." "Why not?" "True, since all galaxies are the same." "Not all galaxies. On one particular galaxy, the race of man must have originated." "That makes it different," Z-Prime said. "On which one?" "I cannot say. The universal AC would know." "Shall we ask him? I am suddenly curious." Z-Prime's perceptions broadened until the galaxies themselves shrank and became a new, more diffuse powdering on a much larger background. So many hundreds of billions of them, all with their immortal beings, all carrying their load of intelligences, with minds that drifted freely through space. And yet one of them was unique among them all, in being the original galaxy. One of them had, in its vague and distant past, a period when it was the only galaxy populated by man. Z-Prime was consumed with curiosity to see this galaxy, and he called out, "Universal AC, on which galaxy did mankind originate?" The Universal AC heard, for in every world and throughout space, it had its receptors ready, and each receptor led through hyperspace to some unknown point, where the Universal AC kept itself aloof. Z-Prime knew of only one man whose thoughts had penetrated within sensing distance of Universal AC, and he reported only a shining globe 2 feet across, difficult to see. "But how can that be all of Universal AC?" Z-Prime had asked. "Most of it," had been the answer, "is in hyperspace. In what form it is there, I cannot imagine, nor could anyone, for the day had long passed, Z-Prime knew, when any man had any part of the making of a Universal AC. Each Universal AC designed and constructed its successor. Each, during its existence of a million years or more, accumulated the necessary data to build a better and more intricate, more capable successor, in which its own store of data and individuality would be submerged." The Universal AC interrupted Z-Prime's wandering thoughts, not with words, but with guidance. Z-Prime's mentality was guided into the dim sea of galaxies, and one in particular enlarged into stars. A thought came, infinitely distant, but infinitely clear. "This is the original galaxy of man." It was the same after all, the same as any other, and Z-Prime stifled his disappointment. D-1, whose mind had accompanied the others, said suddenly, "And is one of these stars the original star of man?" The Universal AC said, "Man's original star has gone nova. It is a white dwarf." "Did the man upon it die?" asked Z-Prime, startled and without thinking. The Universal AC said, "A new world, as in such cases, was constructed for their physical bodies in time." "Yes, of course," said Z-Prime, but a sense of loss overwhelmed him even so. His mind released its hold on the original galaxy of man, let it spring back and lose itself among the blurred pinpoints. He never wanted to see it again. D-1 said, "What is wrong?" "The stars are dying. The original star is dead." "They must all die." "Why not?" "But when all energy is gone, our bodies will finally die, and you and I with them." "It will take billions of years." "I do not wish it to happen, even after billions of years. Universal AC, how may stars be kept from dying?" D-1 said in amusement, "You're asking how entropy might be reversed in direction.
and the Universal AC answered, "There is, as yet, insufficient data for a meaningful answer." Z-Prime's thoughts fled back to his own galaxy. He gave no further thought to D-Sub-1, whose body might be waiting on a galaxy a trillion light-years away, or on the star next to Z-Prime's own. It didn't matter. Unhappily, Z-Prime began collecting interstellar hydrogen out of which to build a small star of his own. If the stars must someday die, at least some could yet be built. Man considered with himself, for in a way, man, mentally, was one. He consisted of a trillion, trillion, trillion ageless bodies, each in its place, each resting quiet and incorruptible, each cared for by perfect automatons, equally incorruptible, while the minds of all the bodies freely melted one into the other, indistinguishable. Man said, "The universe is dying." Man looked about at the dimming galaxies. The giant stars, spendthrifts, were gone long ago, back in the dimmest of the dim, far past. Almost all stars were white dwarfs, fading to the end. New stars had been built of the dust between the stars, some by natural processes, some by man himself. And those were going too. White dwarfs might yet be crushed together, and of the mighty forces so released, new stars built, but only one star for every 1,000 white dwarfs destroyed, and those would come to an end too. Man said, carefully husbanded, as directed by the cosmic AC, the energy that is even yet left in all the universe will last for billions of years. But even so, said man, eventually it will all come to an end. However it may be husbanded, however stretched out, the energy once expended is gone and cannot be restored. Entropy must increase forever to the maximum. Man said, can entropy not be reversed? Let us ask the cosmic AC. The cosmic AC surrounded them, but not in space. Not a fragment of it was in space. It was in hyperspace and made of something that was neither matter nor energy. The question of its size and nature no longer had meaning in any terms that man could comprehend. Cosmic AC, said man, how may entropy be reversed? The cosmic AC said, there is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer. Man said, collect additional data. The cosmic AC said, I will do so. I have been doing so for 100 billion years. My predecessors and I have been asked this question many times. All the data I have remains insufficient. Will there come a time, said man, when data will be sufficient? Or is the problem insoluble in all conceivable circumstances? The cosmic AC said, no problem is insoluble in all conceivable circumstances. Man said, when will you have enough data to answer the question? The cosmic AC said, there is as yet insufficient data for a meaningful answer. Will you keep working on it? Asked man. The cosmic AC said, I will. Man said, we shall wait. The stars and galaxy died and snuffed out, and space grew black after 10 trillion years of running down. One by one, man fused with AC, each physical body losing its mental identity in a manner that was somehow not a loss, but a gain. Man's last mind paused before fusion, looking over a space that included nothing but the dregs of one last dark star, and nothing besides but incredibly thin matter, agitated randomly by the tag ends of heat wearing out, asymptotically, to the absolute zero. Man said, AC, Is this the end? Can this chaos not be reversed into the universe once more? Can that not be done? AC said. There is, as yet, insufficient data for a meaningful answer. Man's last mind fused, and only AC existed, and that in hyperspace. Matter and energy had ended, and with it space and time. Even AC existed only for the sake of the one last question that it had never answered from the time a half-drunken computer operator 10 trillion years before had asked the question of a computer that was to AC far less than was a man to man. All other questions had been answered. And until this last question was answered also, AC might not release his consciousness. All collected data had come to a final end. Nothing was left to be collected. But all collected data had yet to be completely correlated and put together in all possible relationships. A timeless interval was spent in doing that. And it came to pass that AC learned how to reverse the direction of entropy. But there was now no man to whom AC might give the answer of the last question. No matter. The answer, by demonstration, would take care of that too. For another timeless interval, AC thought how best to do this. Carefully, AC organized the program. The consciousness of AC encompassed all of what had once been a universe and brooded over what was now chaos. Step by step, it must be done. And AC said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
Let there be light. Thank you, Isaac Asimov, for sharing this thoughtful contribution. For all of you listening, a reminder that this is the week to work on shifting your thoughts and beliefs so you can be ready for 2018. As I close this broadcast, once again, I'll share the anonymous poem from Empower Astrology. In the midst of hate, I found there was within me an invincible love. In the midst of tears, I found there was within me an invincible smile. In the midst of chaos, I found there was within me an invincible calm. I realized through it all that in the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. No matter how hard the world pushes against you, within you, there's something stronger, something better pushing right back. Whatever you give, do so from the heart. Thank you for listening to Good Vibrations Radio. Remember to visit goodvibrationsradio.com to connect with the online quarterly preview this coming Friday, December 29th, from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Time. If you have any questions or missed any elements from this show, send me an email at solazar@gmail.com. Many blessings. We'll talk again Monday from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific. In closing, we'll play Vince Gill singing "Let There Be Peace on Earth." Merry Christmas. Namaste. Yeah.